Welcome, everyone, to our panel regarding GLP-1 and the GLP-1 landscape in obesity and cardiovascular health, especially from a consumer and investor point of view, brought to you today by our partner for this panel, Tema ETFs. Now, we're going to cover a variety of topics here, ranging from the medical application of GLP-1 treatments to the companies investing in and developing these drugs. Some of those that you may be familiar with already include Ozempic, Rybelsus, and Wegovy with Novo Nordisk, and Trulicity from Eli Lilly. Now, those of you who have attended our spaces before know, as I always say, I like to keep these panels wide open. So kind of as we go along today, anyone on the panel, if you have something to add to any points made by another speaker, feel free to just give it a beat when they're finished and chime right in. The only request that I have as we move along is we keep our microphones muted while others are talking so we don't have any overlap or audio issues. And to our researchers on the panel, I promise not to let my former role as an IRB coordinator seep into the discussion. No amendments to applications needed today. So I'll take a quick moment here to introduce our panelists. First and foremost, we have with us today Moritz Pott, the founder and CEO of today's partner, Tema ETFs. Previously working at Goldman Sachs in natural resources and crude oil trading, Moritz has a good repertoire of experience that eventually led to his founding of Tema that currently manages six separate ETFs, one of which is the GLP-1 obesity and cardiometabolic ETF, ticker HRTS, which we'll be discussing today. Welcome, Moritz, and thank you again for sponsoring this panel and making it possible.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to the conversation.
As do I. Up next, we've got as well the CIO of our partner, Tema ETFs, Yuri Kojamirian. Yuri has over a decade of experience managing UK and global portfolios and co-managed the Magity Fund, raising several billion dollars in assets. He's got a lot of great experience in the space. I'm really excited to have you here today, Yuri. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Next, we've got Dr. Alexandra Soa. Dr. Soa is a board-certified physician of internal medicine with specializations in preventive health and expertise in nutrition and obesity medicine. She's also the founder of Soul, a company focused on helping patients achieve their health goals by optimizing metabolic health and a newer system using GLP-1 supplementation. She's been in this for over a decade, and I'm excited to hear her takes on the sector and the improvements making bounds in the entire space. Welcome, Dr. Soa.
Thank you for having me. I will also add that I'm upcoming author of a book called The Ozempic Revolution by HarperCollins.
Nice. Be on the lookout for that, folks. I'm sure it's a banger. So we will also be joined later, hopefully, assuming we get some cooperation from the Twitter/X platform. I'll be dropping his info here as well. Dr. Eric, a public health scientist and epidemiologist currently serving as chief of COVID task force at the New England Complex Systems Institute. He's also the chief health economist at Microclinic International and co-founder of the World Health Network. His research and works have focused heavily on obesity, nutrition, and cancer prevention, and we're grateful to have his expertise here, and it looks like he might have actually made it into the space finally. Welcome, Dr. Eric Ding.
Thanks. Happy to be here. Sorry I'm late.
Oh, no worries. We were having some issues as well with the platform itself. It's to be expected from these panels, unfortunately. And last but not least, we have BioPharm Catalyst with us today as well, who provides key catalyst updates for publicly traded biotech and pharma companies. With a database encompassing thousands of catalysts, BPC provides real-time information on companies in the sector and upcoming events, reports, and other catalysts for adventure. I'm very happy to have BPC with us today to lend us their biotech investment expertise. Thank you for joining BioPharm.
Thanks a lot, Nick. This is John from BioPharm Catalyst, by the way. Always a pleasure to be on and excited for the discussion.
Pleasure to have you. I'm really excited to get your takes on some of maybe the lesser known catalysts that might be on the horizon. So to start us off here, let's jump right into it. Moritz and Yuri, I'll kind of call on you folks kind of in turn. Feel free to chime in over each other as well. But I want to jump right into this here. Your GLP-1 obesity and cardiometabolic ETF, ticker HRTS, is currently up around 33% since inception. Now, before we really dive into the weeds of these array of topics here, can you give us a bird's eye view of the aims of your ETF?
Yeah, thanks, Nick. So Moritz here, and great again to be on the call. So the HRTS ETF is the world's first GLP-1 and obesity ETF. And obesity is a big challenge in the world today. There's an estimated 1 billion obese people in the world today, forecast to grow to 2 billion obesity cases by the end of this decade. And Novo Nordisk estimates only 3% of current obesity cases are being treated. So this is a big challenge globally across different countries. And obesity is closely tied to other diseases, including heart disease and diabetes. We call it the trifecta of chronic diseases. And therefore, GLP-1 drugs, which were first introduced for weight loss in 2021, are really seen as a breakthrough in terms of the amount of weight loss that they can realize if taken diligently and consistently. And previously, obesity was somewhat overlooked by pharma companies and investors. But we believe this will change as entire industries focus on primary care and treating the root causes of some of these chronic diseases. So remember, when we think about obesity, it's not one disease. It's actually associated with over 200 other comorbidities, ranging from cancer to cognitive function to other neurological disorders. What this fund does, invests in the early winners, but also the next generation innovators in the obesity and GLP-1 space, including cardiovascular metabolic. And that basically ranges from obesity to diabetes, and to some extent also even heart disease. It's managed by a biotech team led by Dr. David Song, who's a trained doctor from Yale University, has a 25-year track record at top places like Rockefeller and Millennium. But it's also advised by the discoverer of semaglutide, which is the raw component behind GLP-1, Professor Jens Juul Holst, who also works with the Novo Nordisk Foundation and is kind of seen as the inventor behind the GLP-1 drug. So that maybe, Nicholas, gives a bit of an in context for what is the fund investing in, who are the people behind it, and what is the experience you bring to the table?
Thank you, Moritz. Yuri, before I move to the next one, did you have anything to add to what Moritz said there?
No, I think Moritz pretty much covered everything about the fund and its objectives. You know, we really see this as a paradigm shift in terms of the pharmaceutical industry and understanding how, you know, it's shifting more towards primary care as we try to treat the root cause of a lot of these diseases. And that's what the fund is investing in.
Good deal. I am looking forward to learning more about that as we move along today. So diving into the weeds a little more, obviously the weight loss battle and rush to release products is a pretty hot topic right now with the recent fame of Ozempic and Wegovy specifically. How big do you think the GLP-1 space will be as a market? And from there, how do you get to that number and what does it mean for the space? I want to start with Moritz and Yuri here again, and then I'd be really interested to get BPC John's take on that as well.
Yeah, look, it's really interesting to think about how big this could get. One of the things that we pride ourselves here at Tema is sort of focusing on structurally growing markets that have a lot of potential over a decade or more. And the thing is that if you sort of think about what it was like 2-3 years ago or even 5 years ago, obesity wasn't really on the scene. And when it did get approved, people thought, you know, this could be a 20-30 billion drug market. And since then, these estimates have just been going up. So Goldman Sachs published an estimate. They think it was 100 billion back in October of 23. And then 6 months later, they upgraded that by 30% to 130 billion. So we did a bit of work here at Tema to figure this out, and we think this could be about $500 billion market, which would make it by far the biggest pharmaceutical market in the world. And I think a lot of this rests in what Moritz said earlier, and we're talking about 2 billion obese individuals by the end of the decade. And if you include overweight, which is anyone who's got a BMI of 25 to 30, you're talking about 46% of the world's population if kind of left untreated. And estimating market size is a bit difficult. You know, we have a big pricing debate, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But in the US alone, if you think about, there's about 122 million adults. And if you assume penetration rates could reach as high as 40%, and that's something that we've seen with other chronic diseases like statins. And if you assume pricing discounted from this price level, you get about a $250 billion market in the US alone. This is supported especially by a lot of out-of-pocket spend in this space, as we know. People are really willing to pay for these drugs. In a survey, about 5% of Americans said they would pay $1,000 per month, and 50% said they would pay $100 per month. So if you have a $250 billion US market, and then you add on top of that international, which is much, much bigger, but prices are lower, as we know, you probably double about that size. So that's how we get to our $500 billion number. And really, the key thing is that as these expectations go up, you see this expansion of the space, which is what we're investing against.
Moritz, do you have anything to add before I pass over to John? All right, John, if you've got some takes there, I'd be really interested in hearing them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I certainly agree with what Yuri had said. You know, I've seen estimates from ranging from $120 to $150 billion by 2031 from a revenue perspective. And, you know, if you look at some of the Jefferies analysis, they came out with analysis that, you know, effectively was trying to determine, you know, who's going to really come out with the most amount of market share in this space. And I think that that is interesting to take a look at, right? I think from what their analysts had said, it was about they're looking at 44% going to Lilly and 36% going to Novo. But that still leaves, you know, 20%. Or so, or around $25 billion up for grabs in revenue by some of these other companies, some of these smaller companies that have entered the space as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see who comes out on top in that. But regardless, I mean, I think the market potential is huge no matter how you slice it. And if you start going further out than 2031, 10, 15 years, it's going to be a lot larger than that. I mean, Ozempic and Wegovy alone have combined for $50 billion in revenue this year and are anticipated to bring in $68 billion by year end. Zepbound from Lilly has had $1.2 billion in Q2, and that was up from $500 million in Q1. So we're definitely seeing significant growth. I definitely think you can't talk about the pharmaceutical industry without talking about you know, the regulatory environment, what ends up happening with the US healthcare system moving forward and insurance companies, what ends up happening with some of the list pricing that, you know, the CEO of Novo was on earlier today discussing with Senator Bernie Sanders. So I certainly think that that is going to be impactful, as well as, you know, what is ultimately covered, right? I think right now, if I'm not mistaken, Wegovy is covered by Medicaid in 20 states. That certainly, the higher that number goes, that will to some degree cut into the potential for profits. But regardless, just given the sheer number of Americans that have this disease, and what we've seen so far, the market size is colossal for sure.
Moritz, I saw you unmuted a bit there. Was there something you wanted to add as well?
The one thing I would add is right now people think about GLP-1 drugs in the context of weight loss, but there's early pretty exciting data that suggests there could also be applications in neurology, for example, dealing with Alzheimer's, sleep apnea, and even potentially oncological disorders. So as we see the use case potentially expand, and of course none of these use cases are approved yet, they're going through trials, we think that market TAM for GLP-1 drugs could only increase if the applications are approved beyond weight loss.
Dr. Eric, I'll see you there as well.
Chime in there for a second. So an interesting point is one of the speakers was saying that Wegovy was approved for Medicaid in 20 states, but it's also been approved globally in Medicare in specific use case scenarios for heart disease prevention. So for secondary prevention with known heart disease. And this makes it really interesting because it's the first weight management drug. It's Wegovy that's approved, not Ozempic. It's the first weight management drug that has been covered by Medicare in over 30 years since there was actually a law that said we will not cover weight loss drugs. And so I would agree that we have very strong data that there are emerging health benefits far beyond and independent of weight loss where these medications will gain approval. The sleep apnea for Zepbound and Mounjaro is very compelling, the data that's been released, and they're pushing hard to get separate indications, and that will really transform what coverage means and affordability.
Yeah, I agree with the other speakers, especially Dr. Soa. There are so many diseases we have yet to even touch on with GLP-1, because these drugs, you know, obesity and diabetes is obviously the most obvious that's been approved for, but sleep apnea, there's already trials that's showing it's likely going to be beneficial. But the sleep apnea market is again, not even the largest. There's so many other diseases, almost every other obesity-related diseases, because in epidemiology, we know that obesity causes, like, basically almost every chronic disease under the sun. We're talking about heart disease, we're talking about cancer, we're talking about kidney diseases, because if you prevent diabetes, you also prevent blindness, right? You know, amputation, you know, kidney failures. Obesity and diabetes, if you reduce these, the follow-on effects of reducing all these other heart disease, strokes, kidney failures is enormous. And the mortality, we know that it's also already been shown to reduce mortality. And there was also another study that shows that it reduces COVID severity as well. So it's quite powerful. I think it reduces COVID severity by, 30% among those infected. So we're just talking about the tip of the iceberg, which is obesity and diabetes. And the market, again, a lot of these other things, you need direct causal proof. But we know that the indirect proof that if you prevent obesity and diabetes, we know that prevention of those diseases will have huge follow-on effects on these other chronic diseases. So we haven't even touched half of all the disease burden yet that we could potentially prevent.
So that actually kind of leads me into what I wanted to ask as well regarding use case, because one of the other aspects of these treatments I found really interesting is, and I think two that I read anyway, two clinical studies, the GLP-1 RAs have been found to potentially increase endothelial function in blood vessels and cardiac function, as well as reduce inflammation and atherosclerosis. And this potential was found in patients both with and without diabetes. And so I'm wondering, especially from a market stance, is this something that'll really, really bolster the potential for GLP-1 moving forward? Or is kind of the market landscape of things right now all eyes glued to that application in obesity treatment?
Well, I'll quickly answer, and I know other people can chime in. Well, obesity right now is the biggest talk in town, because I think a lot of people, as a first-line product for what are you taking this drug for? Why are you injecting yourself? People will oftentimes say, I'm doing it to lose weight, right? For both the health as well as vanity reasons. But I think long-term, we know that these, you know, the endothelial function, you know, inflammation, that's like obvious. There's many other mechanisms as well that I know it benefits. But long-term, I think once the evidence is there, you know, the clinical approval will be much more broader. And I think you know, we know that there's not many good, besides, you know, like a PAP machine for sleep apnea, right? There's and Dr. So, who's an obesity doctor, can describe more. There's not that many other like preventions for, you know, sleep apnea. You know, you have a machine that helps you out breathe, but that's not prevention. I think the actual utility case is going to be so much broader. But right now, obesity is what was the most talked about, even though diabetes came first. Obesity is the main reason that people are taking it. And that's why the marketing is driven all around this. The marketing right now has not caught up with many of the other off-label product use cases yet.
I would just say that obesity is the largest of the problems we're talking about. So while it's also a splashy headline, it really is the largest TAM. It's almost going to be 50% of the United States will meet obesity criteria by 2030. So I think that we address that because it's the largest market and we can prevent so many diseases that come with it. But I do think it will help with government coverage, with insurance coverage, as we get indications that show that this is a far superior treatment to than other available elements, agents on the market. So one thing that we haven't brought up is looking at NASH, which is non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, fat in the liver. So we know that these drugs are reversing this disease. What happens if we don't reverse this disease? It can lead to cirrhosis and liver transplant. So stopping the progression of that disease up front with these medications, hopefully we see as a much better cost investment. And I just think that as we start to work differently about these diseases, we'll start talking about them for different coverage. But right now, obesity kind of is the root cause of all of these other diseases that we're improving with it.
Nicholas, I'm just going to throw one more in there as we're talking about all the potentials. But one of the bits of anecdotal evidence that we've read about, and I say anecdotal because it's not clinical trial evidence yet, although trials are ongoing, is actually an addiction. And it's all kinds of addiction, you know, from alcohol abuse disorder to drugs to other areas as well. And part of this is because of some of the mechanisms Dr. Ding was talking about earlier, which is it affects lots of parts of the body, including the brain as well. And there's obviously a relationship between the gut. It's a gut hormone that it's mimicking and the brain as well. And this could, you know, addiction is probably untalked about because it's so widespread. There's so few treatments for it. And there could be potential here. There are about 6 trials, the last I checked, testing GLP-1s in alcohol abuse, and it'd be really interesting to see what the results of those are.
Thank you all. Moritz, I did see that you unmuted earlier as well. Was there something you wanted to add to their points there?
No, I think the thing I would add is that, you know, obviously today there's still many side effects to taking GLP-1 drugs, which mean that obviously there's a big drop-off rate. And unfortunately, you do have to continue taking these drugs to really benefit from their long-term benefits. So we think as the world looks and moving from injectables to oral, from moving from weekly to monthly dosage, and also looks at other ways of implementation, this becomes a much more viable drug to take, but also to stay on. And therefore, we think actually the impact will only get bigger and more widespread. Right now, it is a painful process for patients who take it. And there's also other challenges, such as muscle loss, which has, again, other risks that it raises. So really, I think that the next real opportunity in the GLP-1 space is how do you deal with some of these side effects to really make the process and the habit much more chronic for patients to also ensure that the effects are permanent and enduring.
So I want to dive on that a little bit more here. Before I kind of get into the weeds of, you know, Ozempic and off-label use, which I do want to get to, I want to touch on that comment Moritz made about sometimes painful for patients. So there are actually some folks in the investment space that believe that in the long term, the drugs won't, and not necessarily something I believe or not, but some say these drugs won't continue to see adoptions long term because of their being administered subcutaneously via an injector/shot. And currently, given how quickly Ozempic and Wegovy have become borderline household names, this doesn't appear to necessarily be true thus far. So I'm wondering, Alexandra, Dr. Soa, in your experience, especially given your new treatment plan using GLP-1, do these EpiPen-style needles act as a deterrent at all for patients, as some have said?
No. I have very little hesitation there, no. And if people do, they are very quickly overcome that fear. And I would say that I really like this recent play by Eli Lilly to release vials instead of the auto-injector pens. And I hope there is a global move to actually give the option at a cheaper price point of putting the medications in vials that need to be drawn up with insulin syringes. I think that there was a lot of fear at the beginning that people would find this off-putting. And so they put a lot of energy and cost into the auto-injector needle pens. But people are quite comfortable actually drawing them up. So I think cost coming down is very exciting when we talk about oral agents or even monthly injectables, which are in development right now. But I do not even think a daily injection, which we've had for years through Saxenda, is a deterrent.
Yeah, there's actually a growing community. For those who don't or aren't familiar with the injectors, like Ozempic comes in these different dosage ranges because you're supposed to dose up. And for understanding, Wegovy is like 2.6 milligrams, while the lowest Ozempic is 0.25, and you're supposed to step upwards from 0.25 to 0.5751, 1.5, all the way up to 2.6 for the Wegovy dose. So Wegovy is a, you know, high dose Ozempic. But what happens is sometimes they sell these injections that are like these injectors with 8 milligrams, but they don't give you the labels for the 0.25 along the way. They give you like the basically the indicator for 2 or 1, and you have to like go all the way. And now there's an online community of, well, I should just get the bigger injectors because they're actually cheaper, and then you just count the clicks. This is a whole thing if you get into deep weeds of this, and it's cheaper to do it, and you get the same dosage that you know you would get if you got the lower, smaller injectors. So, and I feel like this is like these companies, Novo Nordisk, just being, you know, playing a little dodgy to try to charge more, I guess, for these lower values. But people now figured out that when you click them, you can actually get the same low dosage from these bigger dosage pens and actually save money. So it's not off-label use, it's just alternative usage of these injectors. But if they actually had were more transparent with these injectors, how to get lower dosages out of them, you know, patients could actually save more money. So people are figuring this out. And I think the more of these formulations, especially if they have the long-term, you know, better labeling of these needles, alternative way to figuring out these clicks and, you know, longer lasting versions, the market will, this will only grow them, the more transparent and they are with these needles and for patients to save money along the way. And I think, again, we're just at the tip of the iceberg of figuring out also how to quit someday, because right now when you quit, you basically quit in cold turkey. And when you quit off of these very long use drugs for the, you've been using for months and months, if not over a year, from these higher dosages down to zero, it's really hard. Hence you get the rebound. So I think there needs to be, people need to figure out how to dosage your way down as well. And I think that could actually help, you know, with the weight retention so that no one's like quitting cold turkey, right? Just like very few people quit smoking cold turkey, especially if they've been pack-a-day smokers. We have to help people, you know, ease off of these Ozempic drugs if they want to, you know, successfully keep the weight off without being on these drugs potentially forever.
You made a really good point there at the end that I'm going to circle back to regarding potentially putting the weight back on, but I want to put a pin in that because first I want to pick on John Moritz and Yuri here again, just kind of on the topic of companies kind of working in this space. We all know, you know, the Novo Nordisk, we all know the Eli Lilly and company. On last count, there were 400 drugs trying to go after obesity and other metabolic diseases. I'm wondering if you can, for the folks listening today, kind of look at this from an investor's point of view. How do you navigate this vast array of potential future products across several different companies in the sector? I want to start this off with Moritz and Yuri, and then I'd love John's take as well.
I mean, it's a great question. Obviously, if you look back at the obesity space before, it was is sort of unloved by pharma and biotech companies. Even 5-10 years ago, remember Ozempic was a diabetes medication, and just by chance they saw people were losing weight as they were taking it, plus all the positive effects it had in diabetes. And it took, I think, some scientific courage for people to push ahead in obesity, because there have been so many failures before with certain drugs. GLP-1s have been studied for a long time as well, and that was the key thing. They knew a lot about them. Obviously, the space has exploded in the last, I think, decade or so. And this 400 drugs, I think that's on last count. That doesn't mean 400 different companies, but there are lots of different companies. And I think the sad truth about biotech investing is success rates are quite low. So if you just single out your cardiometabolic diseases, which is where obesity sits, if you go from a phase one asset or phase one drug that's in the clinic in its first stage to approval, it's about a 15% success rate. So most of these won't make it through. And this is what makes it so difficult. You have this low success rate, and you have like a plethora of other risks investing. You've got to fund that company before it sees any revenue. You've got all of the clinical and biological risks with your asset. Then you've got the approval by the FDA, and then you've got to get onto the commercial market and get after this primary care market, which requires a sales force and lots of resources, not to mention manufacturing, which is what we've been talking about, making these auto pens and injectors before maybe we get orals. And so to navigate this, you basically need to take an active investment approach, which is what we do. You need expertise and experience in the space, and especially risk management, because things will go wrong, and kind of knowing where to avoid, what risks to avoid and where to take. You know, clinical trial events are binary risks. You know, I'm sure we'll hear about this as well. And a lot of them have an asymmetric risk reward situation. And a lot of it is tilts to the downside, right? Because people get excited about results and they're priced in. And it's realizing what's priced in, which is what we do day in, day out, kind of fundamental analysis, looking at the space, trying to pick the winners.
Thank you, Yuri. John, I'd love your take here as well. Your service also tracks FDA catalyst for companies. And I'm wondering if your team has noticed anything in regards to the obesity and weight management development. What sort of trends are you noticing there? And maybe what maybe lesser known companies are out there in the space pushing forward with this?
Yeah, absolutely. I have several thoughts on this. I do want to emphasize what Yuri had said, because I think it's an extremely important point. Within the US, the FDA is very, very, very strict in terms of its regulatory process, in terms of getting drugs to market. 90% of drugs that go into clinical trials are going to fail. So I think that is just something that you can't, that can't be overemphasized, really, is that there's going to be a lot of players that want to enter the space, but not a lot of them are going to succeed. And what you're going to see, particularly with some of the small biotech companies, is that they're going to have one asset that they're relying on, and they are hoping that they get acquired, very similar to what happened with Roche in December of 2023. They were able to enter the GLP-1 space because they acquired Karma Therapeutics in December of 2023. And that's what you're going to see from some of those smaller biotech companies. But again, it is really important to emphasize that it is a very, very difficult space to succeed in. from the standpoint of trends, I did want to jump back really quickly to the injection versus the oral application of these drugs. I think that one thing that, aside from any of the science, one thing that I have seen is that there is the potential for a somewhat of a manufacturing burden for some of the injectable drugs, just purely from the commercial and from the supply chain side. It can be, it can be costly, and it can be a bit more of a logistical nightmare. And I think, I was reading that there have been some patients that were having issues, refilling some of their obesity medications due to the fact that they were, they were administered by injection. So I think that one thing that we are seeing is a lot more clinical trials start trying to develop drugs, GLP-1 drugs that are orally administered. And I think that there's the potential for a market where, patients are using using the injectable drugs in order to kind of, you know, get down to a certain base weight, and then using the oral drugs to maintain that weight afterwards. That way they don't have to take an injection every single day. Again, I'm not on the science side of it, but that was just something that I was reading just kind of from the supply chain side. Regardless, as I mentioned, we have seen a ton in the way of development for drugs that are orally administered. I'd say right now Lilly is leading that the front on that. They have a GLP-1 asset. It's a small molecule asset that is in phase three now, so it's very far along. Promising phase two data was shared in June of 2023. The results were fairly comparable to the Zepbound injection from Lilly as well. Pfizer is going to be undergoing dose optimization studies in the second half of 2024 for their asset. I mentioned Roche before had the acquisition of Carmot Therapeutics, so they're involved in the space. So those are some of the big players. In terms of some of the smaller guys, the two that really come to mind are Viking Therapeutics and Structure. So Viking has VK2735 being investigated for both injection and oral use. Phase two for the oral use is expected to start in July. And they're looking to jump right into phase three for the injectable version. And then Structure has a small molecule asset that had a successful phase two trial with a phase 2B study expected to initiate in second half of 2024. So definitely a lot of players in the space, and certainly some of those some of the smaller biotechs are getting in there as well. It is possible that they would end up succeeding, but more than likely once they get to later stages and closer to approval or even at approval, they would potentially get acquired by one of the larger players, so they don't have to deal with the commercialization. Those are just my thoughts on that.
Thank you, John. And that actually leads me to another question here. And I'll pick on Moritz for this one, and then I'm happy to kick it around Yuri and John as well. What John just said there, do you think we will be seeing a lot more merger and acquisition activity as other large companies try to grow in this space, maybe acquiring some of those smaller ones, as John said?
I mean, and maybe I'll give 2 cents and I'll pass over to Yuri. I think the reality is, given the approval cycles, I mean, tirzepatide with Eli Lilly, I think they mentioned was an 8-year cycle of approval. If you want to enter the weight loss market today, inquiring is one of the only ways to get around that long approval cycle. And as John mentioned, there's only a limited number of viable targets. So we think that there's obviously a several big pharma companies that don't have any or material exposure to the metabolic space. There's also two players that have early stage exposure. One of them had a failed drug, an oral pill, last year. And therefore, we think it's likely post-election there will be a pickup in M&A activity. But the number of targets is limited, the valuations are high, and still, if you're buying a company before phase three approval, there's still obviously a high degree of risk. So we think there's an intense focus on acquiring something in the oral space. One thing we do think is underestimated in the oral space, it's not much covered, is while it's obviously a more effective delivery mechanism, we also understand that the cost of delivering an oral pill may be lower from a manufacturing perspective, but may actually have a higher total share of active ingredient required for the pill. And in a time when there's still a scarcity of actual availability, while we support the adoption benefits of oral, we are wary that it could still actually accentuate the supply and availability issues we've seen in oral short term. I'll let Yuri comment a bit more on the M&A cycle and what specifically he sees there.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of M&A already happen. Previously, as mentioned, Roche's acquisition, AstraZeneca's licensed a product. If you look at IQVIA data, actually, if they sort of track M&A and transactions over $1 billion, one of the biggest areas is cardiometabolic as a space. It makes sense, right? Because a lot of large pharmaceutical companies, they're facing patent cliffs. They're looking for new areas of growth. And when you have a market that most credible analysts value at sort of 150 billion and could be a lot larger if you start to kind of think about it, they then realize that this could be something that could augment their revenue profile. What's fascinating about that is obviously a lot of the innovation does happen in these smaller biotechnology companies. The large pharma companies have a lot of the raw assets you need, right? Particularly the what I would call like the primary care sales force and the infrastructure to run some of these large trials. Because what we know is, yes, you can prove in phase two, phase three that you've got weight loss, but a lot of these companies will have to start to do outcomes trials, which is what we've seen with Novo Nordisk in their SELECT trial, which is really the watershed moment for this space. This is where, as Dr. Sol was talking about earlier, we proved out this effect on cardiovascular health, right? A 20% reduction in major cardiovascular events. And to run that outcomes trial, it's a pretty big barrier because the next time you run it, you're probably going to have to run it against Wegovy. So the hurdle is higher, which means you have to have more patients, a bigger trial. And this SELECT trial was 17,000 patients, 5 years. So as Morris was kind of alluding to, these development cycles, they take time. And so companies need to kind of start positioning their chess pieces now to get into the game when it comes into the future. And there's all these areas of improvement you can see, as Morris talked about, orals, you know, peptide and non-peptide orals. You've got trying to work on muscle loss. And so there's plenty of room to find niches, whether you emphasize liver disease, as companies like in Denmark, like Zealand Pharma has done, versus others. So I think that there's plenty of space to go here and lots of M&A to come.
Yeah, and I agree with that. There's so many different formulations also. But it's just, you know, just taking the top two, for example, semaglutide is, you know, Ozempic, Wegovy, and then tirzepatide is Zepbound, Mounjaro. You know, we talk about them both as the top two, you know, most prescribed GLP-1. But Mounjaro actually has two different mechanisms. Mounjaro also, you know, tirzepatide, I'll just use the scientific name. It's also a GIP agonist. And we've seen, because of that, you know, GLP is glucagon-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide. It's basically, it also improves your insulin sensitivity and also affects gastric motility. Altogether, if you combine them, the reason Mounjaro is very different, if you combine them together, we know from all the trials that tirzepatide is much more powerful than semaglutide, the Ozempic ones. And we see greater weight loss, greater sustained weight loss, percentage weight, greater blood sugar drops. And so basically one is just a single GLP-1 and one is GLP-1 plus pathway plus another pathway that tirzepatide works on. It works on two different pathways. That's why you see greater effectiveness. And I think we could find other GLP-1 drugs that affect both GLP-1 and another pathway as well. So I think this is, you know, we're expanding beyond just, you know, Ozempic, semaglutide, Ozempic, Wegovy. I think in a few years, we'll see that the Ozempic, Wegovy, semaglutide is probably just the starting product. I think there will be such an array of other products that will be even further enhanced, perhaps for neurological things, perhaps for more targeted for cardiovascular. But I think right now that everyone knows, among the doctors and scientists who know, that tirzepatide is a much more powerful and effective one than semaglutide. And I think that, you know, a potpourri of different products will only further expand.
My hope for the space is that we become a lot more specific based on, I mean, this is years down the road, but I really hope that we are able to kind of target individual needs. Some people do tremendously well on low dose Wegovy, and they don't even need to get to the full dose. And then others need to go all the way up on the dual agonist tirzepatide. You know, looking at what Eli Lilly has in the pipeline with retatrutide, which is a three hormone agonist receiving greater losses. And I hope we're able, kind of even from the get-go, to kind of help people find what will work best for them from the beginning. But what I also see with that is we find these medications that are even more effective. I have a feeling that the most effective medicine won't become necessarily the leader in the market. I think the way that we pay for these medications, we might start to just kind of reserve them for the extreme use cases, and we might start to ration out who gets what, kind of like we see in even chemotherapy, where there are things that work very well, but we only need to reserve them for a select portion of people. So I think it's very, very exciting, the landscape and the pipeline of meds coming.
So I want to touch on that, actually, the topic of tirzepatide, that active ingredient in Zepbound Mounjaro injection. How will developments and approvals of similar drugs like this affect the profitability of manufacturers, for instance, as well as the out-of-pocket costs for patients? I'll see if I can get John's take here, and then I'll pass over to Yuri and Moritz again.
Nick, sorry. So can you just repeat the question? So you're asking about how it impacts profitability. I just want to make sure I understood.
Yeah, exactly that. And maybe the potential out-of-pocket costs for patients.
I mean, look, I think that it's going to be, I mean, on the patient side, I mentioned before, I think that it's going to have a lot to do with what occurs on the regulatory side of the equation. I do think that one benefit of having some of the drugs be orally administered is I think it's a little bit easier for the drug manufacturers to make, right? And I think that it's going to create more competition in the space, which in turn could lead to more approvals from the insurance side of the equation, which is, I think, you know, that's obviously great for folks who are in need. So I really think that it's gonna come down to what occurs with that, and also whether companies like Novo, and what Novo CEO was saying earlier, what they really end up doing with that list price. And I think that one thing that was kind of interesting that was brought into light in that hearing was that it's not so much. And I would be curious to get everyone else's thoughts on this on the line, but it's not even so much whether or not the patients themselves are paying the companies directly, right? I think that there's an indirect cost, right? And Senator Sanders made that clear, in the sense of, you know, they're paying it through a premium. They may not be paying, you know, whatever it is, the $1,300 for Wegovy or the $900 for Ozempic directly, right? And in some cases they are, but they might be paying $25, right? But they also might be paying that cost indirectly through premiums to the insurance company. So there's obviously something that's kind of broken in the system that needs to be rectified. I think that the point that Senator Sanders was making is that they are, that the U.S. consumers are paying for it one way or the other, whether or not it's directly into the pockets of the manufacturers or not. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what occurs with that, and whether or not these companies really do lower the prices, and kind of, again, how the U.S. healthcare system plays out moving forward in terms of overall coverage. But I would love to get other folks' thoughts on that too.
Yeah, that actually does bring me directly to that topic of pricing here. And I'll pick on Moritz and Yuri on this one. It's no secret that medications, especially in the United States, can often carry a daunting price tag, one that often entirely rules out the option for many, if not most, people who would otherwise need the substance. Insulin actually was very famous for this prior to, I think, Eli Lilly and Sanofi announcing that $35 cap on insulin shortly after President Biden called for it last year. Now, given the GLP-1 pricing falls between roughly $1,000 and $1,500 per month, I've kind of got a two-part question here. First, is that pricing fair and sustainable for most people in the demographic that needs it? And second, do you foresee the prices on these drugs dropping anytime in the near future as more companies kind of come into the space, as more substances get approvals? Let's go Moritz and Yuri on this one.
So maybe just to kick off, so what I would say is we expect price to come down, and price already is coming down. And there's a difference already between the list price and the average price that we see consumers pay. And frankly, we think it's only going to go in one direction. And we think that the market here and the need is so big. The need of price went down 80% from the list price. We still see this as a massive opportunity in a big TAM. But we also think manufacturers are going to get smarter, and they're going to find tactics such as Lilly Direct to also recoup some of the investment they're having to make upfront in supply. If you recall, Novo bought Catalent this year. Eli Lilly is expanding two big plants in North Carolina and in Indiana, but also in Europe. So there's big upfront capacity investment being made to meet the supply shortage. We think price is actually not going to be the way it's going to be recouped. We think there's going to be innovative ways they work around packaging of pricing, where there could be ways for them to recoup their investment. Yuri, over to you.
Yeah, look, I think drug pricing is obviously a major issue politically in the US, particularly because drug prices are so high relative to the rest of the world. In many ways, that does fund a lot of the innovation that happens, which I think people shouldn't forget. A lot of these drugs may have not existed if that system didn't exist. But the system in the US is quite complicated, right? You have drug manufacturers, you have insurance companies, and then you have the patients. And because you have the different payer system, you also have these things called pharmacy benefit management organizations, which are currently being, effectively, there's an FTC lawsuit against them about insulin pricing, funnily enough. And they're the middlemen, right? They negotiate the rebates between the drug companies and the insurance plans. And they often take rebates, and those rebates can be also where that money seeps out and the price that paid by the consumer goes to and not to the manufacturers. But look, I think if we take a step back, one of the things, you know, I would mention is that the list price is not the kind of the real price paid for by plans or anyone, really. Often you see big discounts, 40, 50%. So when people talk about this $1,000 or $1,500 for these drugs, it often isn't quite that price paid. We've seen 40, 50% discounts. Yeah, we think that competition is always going to pressure prices, right? Right now, there are just two players in the market. I think they're going slow at it. For them, it's an equation. The lower the price, the more access, but they can't actually produce for this bigger population. And so even if the price was really, really low, but remember, these are peptides, they're complicated molecules to produce. I think Novo Nordisk alone has invested $20 billion in just the manufacturing sites for these drugs and production. And so as we get better, better manufacturing, and then maybe as the orals come in, the price will come down. As you get more competition, the price will come down. That will open up access. And as Moritz says, as we started this conversation, when you have 2 billion potential people that are obese and 4 billion if you take overweight as well, there's a massive market to go after, but it needs a lower price. And then I always go back to the benefit, the clinical benefit, which is what we started this conversation with as well. When you're seeing 20% reduction in major cardiovascular events, benefits in liver, kidney, all of these areas, you get a massive health saving elsewhere. And that massive health saving has been validated by, analysis of Medicare savings, and ICER, has come out with results. And it's an independent third party that thinks that the discounted price is actually quite fair and relative to that makes sense. And so overall, we see it, obviously these things will come down and there will be access in the market, but we think it's justified as a price.
Yeah, and I agree that to the point that more competition will bring down the price. But at the same time, we know what these companies, Eli Lilly and among many others, have done. Whenever prices come down, they start getting creative with the patents. For example, inventing a new injector. Like, I don't know if people saw the 60 Minutes report the other night, in which basically talked about, they added an extra strap to these asthma inhalers, and that extra strap extended the patents, and basically just playing games with the patent to sell a more, keep out generics. And we know all these games that Big Pharma does to extend, many other drugs. I think, I don't know if people know, the Vytorin is just a combination of an old, of two older, statins, statin A and B, that are both off patent, and then they combined it into a combo A plus B, and they called it Vytorin. And they got a brand new patent for it. And these kind of patent games, I feel in certain ways, is just totally disingenuous. And, you know, also PBMs, you know, the games that they play with, the pricing is also atrocious. I think, and also the argument that oh, this drug, this wonder drug will prevent so many diseases, and therefore you can justify the high price. Well, first of all, I think if we ever want to bring down the cost of an American healthcare system, we can't just say, well, we can justify the $1 million price for this drug, or the, you know, $100,000 price of this drug if it saves a lot of lives. But I think, you know, if we truly have a great invention, you know, I think if it's a truly great invention that has a great benefit for society, I don't think that's inherently, especially after the patents are, you know, off patent, we should use that as justification to keep it artificially high with these patent games that the pharma companies are well known to play to extend patents in these high prices. I think it should come down. You know, there's reasons that airplane tickets, they offer huge value to American public, but airplane tickets have actually, you know, adjusted for inflation, been much cheaper than they are before in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And I think just because it has great value to our society should not mean it should, you know, necessarily be at this incredibly unaffordable level compared to average American household income. So I think if it truly is life-saving, it should be as cheap as possible for the greater benefit of society. And I think that's what Senator Sanders is trying to point out.
Some great points there as well. What I want to do here, before we get a little bit more into the investor and business side of things, is I want to pivot back to that point that I mentioned I wanted to follow up on earlier in regard to weight regain. Now, it's kind of a common pattern with myriad explanations and rationales for why weight regain occurs with diets. But it was found that that weight regain was also seen with some surgical solutions as well. A 5-year prospective study back in 2008 on gastric bypass surgery, for example, had found that both weight regain and surgical failure was observed after just 2 months in 50% of participants. So I'm curious, and we'll start with Dr. Soa on this one, is that something that we should expect to see with those receiving GLP-1 treatments, or does data suggest otherwise currently?
Are we talking about people stopping the medications or continuing them and regaining eventually?
Both, honestly. Yeah. I know, like, especially with endeavors that are, you know, a slap a Band-Aid on it type thing, like some could consider surgical remedies. Right. Is that something we might see with GLP-1 treatments as well?
So what we are fixing with these medications is a deficiency of a hormone. And so the majority of people need this medication indefinitely to maintain weight loss. I would say we're a little early in long-term data looking at weight to see what the long-term regain potential is. We've had these medications for 20 years. They are safe. We have been looking at them for weight loss for about 7. The majority of my patients who have been on them for that long maintain their loss. But we do see at about year 5 that some might start to tick up. And that can be a confluence of things. I have a lot of patients in my practice who have had bariatric surgery who did regain and then have lost with these medications and are doing fantastically. Surgeons are starting to pull these medications much faster into post-op care for both enhancement of surgery and to prevent regain. I think what we might see is that the majority, we might come to recommendations that the majority of people should start maybe with the one hormone agonist. And then once you stop, when you plateau or start regaining, then you go up to the 2 hormone agonist and then you bump over to the 3 hormone agonist. I think our body is very, very, very smart at figuring out ways to get back to its fattest point. The fat is not just a nuisance. It is a very powerful hormone, and our body works hard to kind of get back to that place. I will say this is where the holistic approach to weight loss really needs to take center stage, and we're not talking about enough, is that this isn't a magic wand, and people who embrace holistic weight changes have the best response to the medication, but they also do the best in the long run. So it was mentioned that these medications cause muscle loss. They actually don't cause more muscle loss than any other calorie restricted diet, a traditional diet, and they actually do have a better ratio at muscle loss to fat loss, meaning there's much more fat loss that happens. But it's really important that people keep up their muscle mass and then transform how they're working out after they lose weight. We know that strength training will help with it, one, being potentially able to titrate off the medications, but preventing regain. So I think that the field is ripe for a lot of future studies, but anecdotally, a lot of doctors in the space, we can speak to what we're seeing. But it's an important point that these medications, one of the reasons that they are such a large segment of the economy at the moment is that they are really indefinite medications for the majority of people.
Yeah, and I want to add to that, you know, in epidemiology and nutrition, we know that keeping weight down longer has benefits. So it's not just your current body weight, but it's kind of like analogous to cigarette smoking. There's pack years. We oftentimes talk about how many pack of cigarettes you smoke for how many years, pack years. And so there's another concept of BMI years, of like the longer, the more years at a certain higher or lower BMI, the greater or lower the risk of future chronic diseases, right? All the obesity related chronic diseases, which is again like 80-90% of all the chronic diseases under the sun. So I think keeping off long term is really key, because you don't want to be a you know, lose today, regain next year, yo-yoing. You know, yo-yoing diet doesn't keep the long-term benefits that we want to see either for, you know, diabetes prevention, heart disease prevention either. But I think in certain ways, we haven't really done the research on that yet, because we've done research of the direct effects, the immediate effects of these drugs, but we haven't done research on how to keep the weight off, right? And weight maintenance, as we say. Obviously, diet, exercise, the holistic other things that we need to do is important. But I also feel like, you know, weight loss, you know how like when they try to lose weight initially, lose 5 pounds, but then the next 5 pounds gets harder to lose. And next 5 pounds gets harder to lose. But if you lose enough, you go over this hill. Basically, there's a hill and valley theory with a lot of weight loss, that if you have the willpower or the, you know, the exercise or, you know, the medication assistance to get over this hill, to, so you don't keep sliding into the valley that you started in, the starting weight, that if you get over the hill to the next valley, then you'll still have the hill valley effect, but at least you're in a different weight loss valley. And if you can keep it there for a long time, and their thinking is that, you know, just like smoking, instead of quitting cold turkey, once you get them over the hill, you can help them stay there. And maybe we can use a lower dose to keep people, you know, at this next hill. Maybe you switch to oral. Maybe we can do other things to, once they've lost, you know, the huge 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds that they've needed to initially with this drug, maybe that we can find a way to keep them there at the lower weight, because weight maintenance is so key. And just like we know that with social networks, that, smoking, obesity, drinking, all these things have social network influences that, you know, once we get to a different place in our society where, people have lost the weight, we could actually use not just diet, exercise, or in lower dosage, but also have the social network, you know, just kind of like you have, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous AA meetings to help people, you know, not fall back into alcoholism. We can maybe help people not fall back into the initial valley that they started with, but stay in the lower weight valleys. And I think this is the thing we have not studied. And I think the tapering down thing I was mentioning earlier, you know, we're basically all the trials with the weight rebound is basically everyone stopping the drug cold turkey from the high dose that you've built up over many months and cold turkey quitting. I don't think that's a really good idea at all. And that's why you see the enormous weight regain. But I think once we figure out how to taper optimally, how to switch to other, you know, lower dosage maintenance, we can hopefully not require the high dose the rest of your life, but keep it in a maintenance and stable valley.
Thank you, Dr. Sowa and Ding. I'll be really interested to see how things pan out. As I mentioned, I used to be an IRB coordinator, so I'm always really interested to get these research takes on things like this. So thank you very much for those points of view. One thing I want to touch on before we send folks off into the ether of the afternoon is I want to go back to the comments that both John and I think it was Yuri made in terms of risk when it comes to the biopharma sector. And obviously that's the case in many facets of the markets, but it does seem that the biopharma sector has, you know, a lot more factors at play, maybe from regulation to FDA updates and approvals, sort of driving and controlling the reaction from investors and by proxy, the stock price. So what I want to do here is kind of a two-parter. I'll start with John. What are some things that investors can do to kind of navigate these risks when looking at companies other than, you know, the big names that are kind of a constant on people's minds like Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk?
Yeah, sure. As you mentioned, I mean, obviously, you know, there are huge risks when it comes to investing in the biotech sector. I think that, you know, doing as much due diligence as you possibly can on the individual companies and just their general track record. Like I mentioned before, I mean, if they have one asset, right, that they're looking at, you know, really closely following how successful the clinical trials have been, and really kind of taking a deeper look at that underlying, and even if you're not a scientist, right, taking a look at how successful each one of those phases was, right? They have to file for the IND, they have to go through phase one, they have to go through phase two, they have to go through phase three. Usually it's about a 10 to 15 year process for most companies. So really tracking that closely, that's something that we do. We at BioPharm Catalyst, we're tracking all of those stages of the clinical trial process and letting folks know when those key milestones are going to be coming up, as well as what the results from that data was. I think that's certainly something that folks can do. I also think that, you know, you have to look, biotech investing is not, you know, it's not just a matter of whether or not something is, whether or not one of these companies was successful during one of their phases. So you have to take a look at the whole picture, right? And really see how that is progressing along. A lot of times what we see within biotech is what we call the biotech run-up, right? When you're looking to invest in some of these companies, is that you'll see the stock price actually go up in weeks or months leading up to one of these key data readouts. So, you know, a lot of folks will actually take that approach to the investing as opposed to trying to place a quote unquote a bet. I don't like to use that word, but, you know, on whether or not something is going to be successful. The reality is that a lot of times we don't know what is going to actually occur, but really kind of paying close attention to when those events are occurring, and possibly using some of that biotech run-up to trade that ahead of some of those events is what we see a lot of folks use our website for. And then finally, I mean, you know, we mentioned M&A. I think that just taking a look at potential, you know, partnerships, like is there a large pharmaceutical company that has a certain area that they are lacking, right? Or that they're trying to, you know, they don't do this particularly well. And then is there a smaller biotech company that may, you know, that may play in that space, and there could be a potential for acquisition, especially now with the Fed cutting interest rates. We do think that the biotech market is ripe for some more expansion at the end of this year and into 2025. So those are just some things that folks can do and can pay attention to when looking to invest in these companies.
Thank you, John. Yuri and or Moritz, kind of as a tag on there, how do your actively managed ETFs address these sort of risks in the GLP-1 obesity landscape?
Yeah, I mean, those are all great points. I'll probably just tag along on all of those to try to explain how we think about it. I think this point about how the company's track record, the people involved, what we call kind of the R&D operating base, you know, the leadership in place, what have they done before? This is really, really important, making sure the companies have that. I think the point about the run-up in data is just invaluable because it's about these risk-reward situations. Nature did a fantastic study of like all of these binary events. And what they found is they tend to skew negative in terms of returns. And that's why a passive approach to biotech doesn't really work because you're more exposed to these passive events. So the stock prices tend to drift up into the event. And then if it's a negative event, they fall a lot. And so the distribution is negative. And so you have to make sure you have the right odds on the table, sorry to use a bet analogy, to have positive risk reward situations where you're basically being paid to take that risk. And then just doubling up on that operating base, that look, we try to invest in innovative companies, not companies that are doing kind of me too stuff. And I think this goes back to Dr. Ding's point, which is if you're really providing innovation, yeah, there are tricks and things people will play for sure. You know, it's a commercial business. They'll use everything they can. But if you're investing in good innovative companies, they're bringing value to everyone on the table. And that's what we're trying to do. And then just finally on this point about the biotech market is, you know, look, it's just been left behind. We've had one of the worst bear markets in biotech since 2021. We've seen a small pop at the end of 23 and into this year, but actually there's a long way to go. Other parts of the market have recovered and we think it's a very interesting time.
Thank you, Yuri. Moritz, did you have anything to add to what Yuri said?
No, I would add nothing. The only thing I would add is that, you know, coming back to risk, this is a very exciting space, but this is going to be a space where there's going to be unforeseen outcomes, especially for some of the emerging players. So you need experience and you need to manage both the downside risk in order to benefit from the long-term upside opportunity. And we think that really does need someone with a scientific background. That's what we have. And in the space, in biotech specifically, what you often see is that there's big binary events. Binary events have big outcomes on companies. And you can't foresee these events, but you can manage the risk around those events. And that's really at the core of what we do at Tema. We think the long-term tailwinds in the GLP-1 space are incredible. We could see a world where half the world's population could be on a GLP-1 drug, a bit like statin. But we think in the run-up to that process, there will be a number of unforeseen outcomes. Could be regulatory, could be commercial, could be medical, could be go-to-market. And therefore, having a very close finger on the pulse and identifying both the winners of today and the innovators of tomorrow is at the heart of what we do every day.
I don't think anyone could have said that any better. Thank you, Moritz. So what I want to do here before we head off is I just want to kick around the panel and any closing thoughts that we maybe didn't get to during the brunt of the panel that you want put out there or anything you're working on related to the space, please feel free to. I'm going to start with John here. Any last closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think it was a great discussion, Nick. I really think that we hit on a majority of the points. Look, I mean, I think that just kind of summarizing everything, obviously there's going to be a high focus on pricing going forward. That's something to pay very close attention to, and just seeing, you know, how that, you know, what ends up happening with these larger companies, whether or not we see those list prices start to come down and kind of how we see the insurance companies covering these moving forward. How I know that there was a comment on in the thread, I don't think we got to it, just on an upcoming bill that is potentially going to be passed with respect to this and what's going to be covered in under Medicare. I think that's going to be something to watch out for and to just see how to see how that plays out with Medicare and Medicaid and the insurance companies. I mentioned some of the key catalysts and some of the key companies that are going to be playing in this space. I definitely think, you know, paying attention to and staying on top of some of those clinical trials. And I think that we're going to continue to see more of that moving forward. And like I said, I think that, you know, with the way that the market is right now, I think the Fed is due to potentially cut interest rates by another 0.5% before the end of the year. I think we're really setting ourselves up for a strong 2025. Hopefully, you know, we might even see some more M&A as well as IPO activity. Maybe not quite 2021 levels, but certainly better than what we've seen the last couple of years. So I definitely think it's an exciting time. And, you know, I also really appreciate everyone else's thoughts on the call. I thought everyone did a really great job and gave perspectives in areas that I couldn't. So thanks for everyone else on the call and your guys' thoughts.
And of course, thank you. And thanks for coming, John. I really appreciate you being here today. Dr. Ding, anything you wanted to get out there about the GLP-1 space before we send people off?
Well, I think this is a really great discussion for many different perspectives. I think pricing is going to be really big, but I, as the public health scientist here with no pharma conflict with any products here, I just hope they bring it down to a reasonable price and reasonable out-of-pocket pricing structure that everyday, you know, low income, average working class Americans can afford it. Because right now, the price of this is completely out of reach of average Americans, and it's not covered by most insurance companies, or they can't find a doctor who is willing to prescribe it so that it's covered. I think I really hope we can bring it down to that level. And you know, we talk about trials, but the problem is that the pharma is not incentivized to do trials on how to ramp down the usage, right? Because it's against their financial interest. But I think there will be a push, and we need a way to somehow figure out how to ramp down dosages eventually once people achieve their desired weight. Because right now, the pharma companies absolutely will not fund more trial money to do weight maintenance of how to reduce the use of their product. Let's be honest, right? And I think there will be a lot of there will be millions of these GLP-1 drug medicine users, and I hope someday we all come together to do collective like public health research of actually how to ramp down to a more reasonable level instead of staying at these high dose drugs levels forever that the pharma prefer we stay at once we achieve the weight target. So I think weight maintenance will be a huge thing that in the near and future horizon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Dean, and thank you again for coming and lending your medical expertise to this today. Dr. Soa, anything you wanted to add there?
I just think it's always good to remember that we're talking about these massive billion dollar economies of scale and talking about pipelines and, you know, investments. But at the end of the day, these are revolutionary medicines that are changing individual lives for the better. And so I'm just excited for them.
Hopefully things ramp up in the way that benefit most, if not all. Thanks again for coming, Dr. Soa. Now, Yuri and Moritz, is there anything that you wanted to touch on regarding your ETF, HRTS? And, you know, as the sponsors of the show, I'm really grateful that you guys sponsored this today and let this discussion come to fruition. This panel wouldn't have happened without you guys. Really grateful to really get this information out in such a way that everyone from the consumer side to the investor side can kind of understand what's going on and what to expect. Is there anything you wanted to discuss, all things Tama, before we send folks off into the afternoon?
Thanks, Nick, and thanks, Will, so much for having us on the show today. And thanks for all the speakers who joined. We really enjoyed the conversation. I think tagging on Dr. Sola, I think the biggest opportunity here is to improve patients' lives. And given how many people are affected today by obesity, we think that's first and foremost the most important and biggest opportunity here. And we think there's a number of responsible companies that are increasingly going to be focused on doing better things for patients, which in this case means reducing pricing and offering improving the access, the affordability, and the ease of application for these drugs. So we think this is one of the biggest opportunities, game changers both for public health, but also frankly for pharma outlook. And we think that the advancements we see in the GLP-1 space will likely extend quickly beyond weight loss, which is why we see a world where half the world's population could one day even be on a GLP-1 drug. That's still a long way to go, but we think this could have a similar impact as we've seen with drugs like statin before in chronic disease. So from a firm perspective, we're very grateful for this opportunity. We continue to produce a lot of research and really focusing on content, bringing experts like the inventor of GLP-1 to the work we do and educating and sharing that with the community. I think, Yuri, you may have some closing thoughts on the investment side you want to share.
I think we're very excited about this space and investing in it. We think, just echoing what Dr. Sowa said, is the innovation is just mind-boggling what's been achieved here. I've been looking and investing in the space for well over a decade, and I've never seen quite anything like it. We used to talk about Alzheimer's as the biggest market, and now it's obesity, really come out of kind of nowhere. And it's really these leading companies that have done this, and the companies are coming after it. And hopefully we will have this situation where it's maintenance treatment, the weight doesn't come on, and suddenly we can transform. And I think one of the things we didn't touch on is the economic benefits all of this could bring to human health and life and society over a long period of time. But just wanted to also say thank you to all the speakers that joined. It was a really insightful conversation, and hopefully we can all look forward to more clinical data and exciting developments in the years ahead.
Absolutely, and all eyes up, watching to see what happens in the sector. Thank you again to Tama ETFs for sponsoring this panel and making it possible. If you want to learn more about the HRTS, GLP-1 and obesity ETF, just head on over to TamaETFs.com. As Moritz said, they have a ton of research there. They have a ton of potential forward-looking statements there. So if you're interested at all in the topic, everybody on the panel today is an excellent follow for exactly that. And of course, TamaETFs.com, their HRTS ETF for the GLP-1 and obesity space, is a good place to go for that information. And if you're interested as well in learning more about the investment side of things, they've got plenty of that there as well. So thank you again to Tama ETFs and to all of our panelists today. If you came in late and missed anything, don't worry about it. I'll have this posted on Spotify, Apple, and YouTube as an Unusual Whales podcast episode, so you didn't miss anything at all. Thanks again to everybody for coming, again to Tama ETFs, and I hope everybody has a great rest of their day.